Don't blame her. I almost did the same thing. One of the men is Wayne Gibson.
Do they know we're here? Cat whispers. Is that why they've come?
I don't know the answer. I do know that our car is going to stay parked right where we left it. Milo returns. At first, I didn't realize how important the laptop could be. But as soon as I saw what was on it, I came to recognize it for what it is. Serious leverage. Thanks to Milo's digital clone, we should be able to demand the release of Marlow, Gorog, and Busara's dad, James Agubu. We may even be able to force the company to kick the headset players out of Otherworld. Whether the contents of the laptop will be enough to take down the entire corporation remains to be seen. Ribby? Elvis calls from the bathroom. Cat looks at me and rolls her eyes. We've been holed up for 2 days in a Best Western in Brooklyn, not far from my mother's childhood home and the fragrant waters of the Gowanus Canal. We drove straight here from Milo Yolkin's house in New Jersey, and aside from a single excursion, we haven't left the room since we got here. I couldn't possibly be more ready than I am right now.
Ready?
Elvis asks again when neither of us answers immediately. Yes! Cat shouts back. The bathroom door opens. A second later, Milo Yolkin strolls out, a small metal sphere trailing behind him. He's wearing his trademark hoodie and gray sneakers. His curly blonde hair bounces a bit with each step. Milo stops in front of us, pivots slightly, smiles, and waves. Then he walks on. When he reaches the door of the hotel room, he and the sphere both come to a stop, and then Milo Yolkin disappears. Cat and I break into wild applause, and Elvis and Busara emerge from the bathroom to take a bow. They look remarkably fresh for two people who stayed up all night resurrecting Milo Yolkin.
That was amazing, Cat gushes. What else can he do?
That's it for now, Elvis says. That's it? I ask. I can tell from the frown on Busara's face that it wasn't a smart thing to say.
Do you have any idea how hard it was to put that together? Elvis chides me. Yolkin had just started cloning himself. We didn't have much to work with.
It's more than enough for now, Cat says, unconvincingly. You guys did great.
See? Elvis says to me. She knows how to recognize genius.
Still, is it going to be enough? We'll need the hologram to do more, won't we? I ask. We have to convince the company that Milo 2.0 is under our control. If Hologram Milo shows up in public, investors will assume the boy genius is alive and well. The price of the company's stock is bound to soar. But if he happens to get hit by a New York City bus in front of thousands of witnesses, the stock price will tank and never recover. The company needs to believe that we're capable of destroying them financially. Otherwise, they'll never meet our demands. Elvis starts to argue, but Busara puts a hand on his arm. It's the first time I've seen her make such a tender gesture towards anyone. Elvis seems surprised, too. He's marveling at the hand like it's the most magical object in the universe. I'm starting to wonder if he's actually made some progress with Busara when she blinks and appears to come to her senses. In a flash, the hand gets snatched away. It all happens so fast that I'd probably doubt my own eyes if Cat hadn't caught it all, too. I know because one of her bony fingers is currently poking me in the thigh. It's the private language Cat's used since we were both 8 years old.
It's good enough for today, Busara says. You and Cat go out and bring Milo back from the dead. Elvis and I will stay here and get back to work.
Another deranged Milo Yolkin hologram coming up.
Elvis is suddenly chipper again.
By tomorrow, Cat asks, that's when we'll need the second hologram if the plan's going to work, so no screwing around.
Excuse me?
Busara asks, as if the idea of screwing around simply does not compute.
Is that supposed to be a joke?
Cat rolls her eyes. Never mind, she says. It's been a long time since I've been around so many people. Rockefeller Center is packed for the filming of a top-rated morning show. Today, the crowd might even be bigger than usual. A teen star is here to promote his latest movie, and the square is filled with squealing 10-year-old girls and their indulgent parents. The adults all look the same to me, like mannequins dressed in slightly different outfits. If I didn't know any better, I'd swear they were NPCs. The interview they're waiting for will be taking place on the other side of a giant window positioned a few feet above street level. The movie star and the show's host are milling about the studio, chatting while a news segment is filmed. I recognize a publicity photo that flashes up on a monitor. The subject of the news segment is a well-known movie director.
"Who's that?"
someone beside me asks.
"Some Hollywood guy. They say he attacked an actress and tried to kill her. She had to hide in a bathroom to get away."
Inside the studio, a picture that must have been taken at the crime scene replaces the first photo. It's the same guy, his shirt wet with sweat and his chunky black glasses askew. I turn my attention to the task at hand.
"You're sure this is going to work?" I ask Kat.
"I keep forgetting that you never watch television," Kat says. "The cameras always pan the crowd between segments. Someone watching will spot Milo. That's all we need. The footage will be all over the internet by noon. You have the projector ready?"
"Yep."
I lift the shopping bag in which digital Milo is waiting.
"Don't get caught on camera," Kat says, pulling the bill of my baseball hat down.
"I'll try." I grab her and kiss her.
"Let's do this."
There's a roped-off path that cuts through the crowd. I station myself behind a giant dad at one end of the square. Kat's on the other side, crouched behind a lady with a cloud of curly hair. I put the projector down on the ground. All it has to do is roll 60 feet in a straight line. I wait until the people in the crowd throw their arms in the air, then I turn Milo on. The small silver ball produces its three-dimensional hologram. As it rolls silently across the concrete, Milo takes his first few steps. A little girl barreling down the path runs straight through him. My heart is pounding and I feel a bit dizzy, but everyone's arms are still in the air and no one seems to have noticed. Inside the studio, the teen star has come to the window to wave at the crowd. His face is at least 60% smile, and he can't be more than 4 feet tall. He doesn't look totally human, if you ask me. Then, I see him do a double take and point outside. I can't hear what he says, but his lips seem to form the words, "Milo Yolkin." The television show host rushes to the window for a look. He says something to the crew, and the cameras are suddenly up against the window. The timing couldn't be more perfect. At that very moment, Milo stops, pivots, and waves. Then he continues walking. Once he's behind a lamppost on the other side of the square, I make him disappear. I see Kat snatch the sphere and vanish into the crowd. I meet her on the corner of 56th and 6th Avenue as planned, and we catch the subway downtown. Our next stop is a computer store in another tourist trap part of Manhattan where we can use the devices on display to check out the news. The employees are all too busy staring at their own phones to pay us any mind. The video of Milo is everywhere. It's trending on every social media outlet. Even the newspapers have already picked up the story and are reporting that the boy genius is alive. In the 30 minutes it took to get here, the company's stock price has shot through the roof.
"That was fast," Kat notes merrily.
"Ready for stage two?" We picked out the spot yesterday, a cafe on a side street in Lower Manhattan. It met our two big requirements, lots of people inside the cafe, but not many people on the sidewalk outside. There's also a mailbox in front of the building where we can leave a hidden message for the company to spot. Today, it will be a single word written in Sharpie. Nemi. Kat and I loiter outside for 15 minutes, waiting for the sidewalk to clear completely. Then, standing out of view, I set the projector down on the sidewalk. Milo Yolkin appears, walking slowly past the cafe window. Once he's passed, the hologram disappears, and Kat snatches up the projector on the other side. I'm starting to worry that no one in the cafe witnessed the show. Then, two people rush out the door, their smartphones in their hands. They look both ways, but Milo is gone. They're already typing away as they return to their tables inside. Success achieved. Kat and I head to another computer store, this one in Soho. Two pictures of Milo outside the cafe are already making the rounds on Twitter. One is little more than a blur, but the second is clear as day.
Milo Yolkin is already trending on Twitter, just a few places down from the homicidal movie director.
Do you think they'll notice our message? Kat asks.
I expand the photo. Yeah, they'll notice. The word on the mailbox is perfectly legible. Nemi will mean nothing to anyone who doesn't work for the company. It's a deserted realm Kat traveled through during her time in Otherworld. Wayne and the engineers will be scouring all the images for information. They'll know how to interpret it. We're arranging a meeting. The where has been answered. The when is yet to come.
Kat and I head back to Brooklyn to drop off the projector with Elvis and Bussara. Then, we leave them to work their magic in peace.
Wandering the nearby streets, Kat and I end up on one of the bridges that span the Gowanus Canal. The surrounding neighborhood isn't what I was expecting. It used to be one of the most desolate parts of the city, and the mob's favorite dumping ground for dead bodies. There are still a few scrap metal yards and a couple of coffin factories, but now luxury apartment buildings are rising up among them. The buildings along the banks of the canal are some of the priciest addresses in Brooklyn, which is doubly surprising, considering the whole place smells like crap. Kat and I stop on the south side of the Union Street Bridge and peer down at the water. A wave of brown foam is making its way toward New York Harbor, carrying lumps of fecal matter along with it. I feel Kat's hand on the small of my back, and I wonder if she's thinking the same thing I am. Somewhere down there, among the oil spills and chemicals, is my grandfather's final resting place.
We haven't had much time alone together, Kat says.
I turn my attention to her. Whenever my eyes are on her, I can't imagine ever looking at anything else.
Yeah, when I daydreamed about the two of us, this wasn't exactly what I had in mind, I admit.
You daydreamed about us? She teases me.
Every single day since I was 8 years old, I tell her.
Liar, she laughs.
But it's the honest truth. I can't remember daydreaming about anything else. I lean down and kiss her. Just as our lips make contact, I feel a strange tingling at the base of my skull. I glance up to see that we're being watched. There's another bridge a few blocks down, and a man is standing at the railing looking north at us. He's wearing a plaid suit that belongs to a different era and a fedora cocked at a raffish tilt. I'm too far away to see him clearly, but when he turns to his side, the outline of his giant nose makes him easy to identify.
Do you see the man watching us from the other bridge?
I ask Kat before it occurs to me that I shouldn't.
What man? She asks. If he were really there, she'd be looking right at him. He hasn't budged an inch.
Never mind, I tell her.
My grandfather wants to speak to me. Until recently, he only appeared in other worlds or my dreams, but this is broad daylight. There's not even a cloud in the sky.
Simon?
I feel Kat's fingers slip through mine. She's concerned. She should be.
Are you okay?
Yeah, forget it, I say, squeezing her hand and forcing a smile. I think the stress is starting to get to me. I finally get time alone with Kat and my brain betrays me. My luck's never been great, but it keeps getting worse. For the next hour, Kat and I walk in silence around the neighborhood until we turn back toward the motel. We're still a couple of blocks away when we see the building. It rises several stories above the rest of its neighbors. Bland, new, and clean, it hardly fits in with the weird, old, and grimy. It's like something sculpted out of plastic with a 3D printer. Suddenly, I lurch backward. Kat's come to a stop and grab my arm.
Look,
she points up at the roof. There's a figure standing on the edge, staring down at the earth like a gargoyle on a French cathedral. I know what it is, and Kat does too. We don't need to discuss. We both break into a run. We stop across the street from the motel's lobby. We can see him clearly from here. Milo Yolkin is standing on what must be a ledge that circles the roof. The tips of his sneakers are sticking out over the side, and his curly blonde hair is dancing in the breeze. It's so brilliant I almost want to applaud. Elvis and Bussara have taken the simplest image imaginable, a man standing still facing the camera, and turned it into someone who's literally on the edge. A cab pulls up in front of the motel, and a couple of Midwestern tourists wearing the pastel costumes of their native land climb out. They notice Kat staring at the sky and glance up to see what has her so mesmerized. They don't look like the sort who'd be able to identify Milo Yolkin. All they see is a man who's dead set on testing the laws of gravity.
"Oh my God, Justin, dial 911!
The woman screeches at her husband, who's frantically patting down the countless pockets in his cargo shorts in search of his phone. I don't know whether it's purely coincidence or if Elvis and Bussara heard the commotion, but at that very moment, Milo Yolkin disappears. The tourist puts his phone down and looks at his wife. They've been in Brooklyn for less than 2 minutes, and they've already had the shock of their lives.
"Did you see that?"
the woman asks as Kat and I make our way past them into the hotel.
"You mean the pigeon orgy up there on the roof?"
Kat asks with a perfectly straight face.
"What? No," the man says. "The guy, about to jump."
"Nope, didn't catch that," Kat tells him.
The woman's hand flies up to her lips, and her eyes widen in horror.
"Justin," she gasps, "do you think it could have been a ghost?"
She has no idea how close she is to the truth. Milo Yolkin may have passed away, but he hasn't vanished. He's risen from the grave like a restless spirit with a score to settle. I'm back on the bridge over the Gowanus Canal. The fancy buildings are gone. Everything is dark, and the only sound is that of the sewage lapping against the banks. "Don't do that again," I tell the man standing next to me. "Don't come to see me when Kat's around."
"You think I want to show this face in the light of day?"
he asks.
"I didn't visit on purpose."
That means neither of us is in control.
Shit.
"You said it. She needs to know,"
the Kishka tells me.
"You can't keep it from her."
"Keep what from her?" I demand.
"That something's wrong."
I've been trying to ignore it, but the truth never goes away.
"What is it?"
I ask him.
"Do you know?" "All I know is that none of this is right," he says. "I haven't figured out how, but it ain't."
I hear a splash below. My gaze drops to the surface of the water. There's something down there, something white and fleshy. I wake up in a sweat. Kat's bare arm is lying across my throat, and there's a mattress spring jabbing me in the back. Kat must have opened the window. The smell of the canal always grows stronger at night. For reasons that are clear to anyone with an ounce of common sense, accessing a Manhattan rooftop is usually no easy feat. But, thanks to the company, Elvis has a blueprint of every building on the island downloaded on his glasses. Not only can the glasses guide you to the access stairs, they'll show you which security wires to snip when you reach the locked door at the top. The four of us together would have drawn attention, so it was decided only one of us could do the job. Aside from the shaved strip on the back of her head, Kat's hair is long enough to cover the AR glasses' unusually large temples. The rest of us are standing across the street, waiting for the show to begin. I don't like this one bit. Now I know how Kat felt when I've left her for Otherworld. I won't breathe easily until she's completed her mission and returned to me. Unfortunately, the weather is not cooperating with our plans. The sky has grown dark and the wind is picking up. Powerful gusts race through the city's canyons, and every few minutes, there's a rumble of thunder in the distance. A storm is rolling in. We don't have phones anymore, so none of us check the weather. There are thousands of people on the street, but none of them are looking up. Everyone is rushing to get inside before the rain arrives. There's a clap of thunder overhead, and a drop splatters against my forehead. Milo Yolkin appears on the ledge of the roof, holding his sign. No one down below notices. I'm starting to think it's all a lost cause. Then, Bussara steps forward, points a finger in the air, and screams. The sidewalk traffic immediately comes to a halt. Within seconds, a crowd of people gathers, all staring up at the man about to jump. Dozens of phones are filming the scene. I only hear one person dial 911. No one else wants to miss a second of the action. It makes me want to pack up and leave them all at the mercy of the company. I'm not sure any of these jerks deserve to be saved. A guy next to me is zooming in on the figure, hoping for a close-up.
"Oh, damn!" he says.
Is that Milo Yolkin?
Milo Yolkin?
Someone else repeats, and the news spreads through the crowd. Cars on the street have come to a stop, and people are climbing on top of taxis for a better view.
What's he holding?
A sign that says noon.
What the hell does that mean?
Don't jump, a woman shouts. We all love you.
Release Otherworld!
The end is near.
Hey, says someone nearby. I'm in Midtown, and Milo Yolkin is about to jump off a roof.
What?
Yeah, I'm serious. So short the company stock. Hell yes, I'm sure. Just do it.
He ends the call and lifts his phone back up in the air and hits record.
Go ahead and jump, you little idiot, he says.
Then the clouds break and the rain pours down. Within seconds, the witnesses are drenched and their phones rendered useless. The devices are quickly tucked away, but otherwise no one budges.
Hey, why isn't he getting wet? A girl asks.
She's right. Milo Yolkin is standing in the middle of a thunderstorm, but he and his sign are still perfectly dry. Thankfully, no one has caught it on camera. There are sirens heading our way. I'm about to lose it when Milo Yolkin takes a step back from the edge and vanishes from view. The four of us are back at the hotel by 10 a.m., soaked to the bone by the storm that refuses to stop. For the next 2 hours, we listen to the rain pound the neighborhood while we watch the cable news coverage of Milo Yolkin's bizarre appearance on a Manhattan rooftop. The company's share price has plummeted. The red line on the stock chart in the right-hand corner of the screen looks set to drill through the bottom of the television and down into the center of the earth. An ad comes on, and like a bunch of addicts, we all reach for the remote at once. Whoever gets it switches the television to the next news channel. The screen is split. On one side of the line is a woman dressed like she's on her way to a cocktail party. On the other is a handsome man with a scruffy chin and thick black glasses. It's a carefully cultivated look that's supposed to tell us he's both exceptionally brilliant and devastatingly cool. The costume doesn't quite suit him. I'm here with Ryan Boomcock, CMO of the company and a personal friend of Milo Yolkin, says the woman. Ryan, were Milo's actions this morning a cry for help? Ryan laughs, taking the anchor by surprise. I lean in closer to the television. Maybe it's just the studio makeup, but if I didn't know better, I'd say that Ryan was one of the company's less convincing robots. Everything about him is uncanny valley.
A cry for help, he echoes. Of course not. It was an announcement. Milo wanted to make it himself, and as we all know, he's always had a flair for the dramatic. Perhaps he took it a little too far, but you got to admit, he certainly got everyone's attention.
An announcement? The woman asks.
We're releasing the first trailer for our latest software. We were planning to post it to the company website at noon.
Okay, I'm officially impressed. This is some serious jujitsu.
We come at them, and they use the attack to their own advantage. If the company pulls this one off, maybe they deserve to be humanity's evil overlords after all.
How exciting! The tone of the interview has instantly gone from gloomy to giddy. Can you tell us more?
How about we just give you a sneak peek at the trailer? Ryan asks.
He's running the show now. They cut to the video, which opens on an image of Earth from space.
For thousands of years, this little blue planet has been our home, says a man's voice.
Holy shit, I gasp. Is that Tom Cruise?
Elvis has gone sheet white.
It could be, he admits.
I can practically see his mind spinning as he tries to figure out if it's just a coincidence and what it could mean if it's not.
Shh, Bussara orders.
The camera is now hurtling toward Earth, closing in on North America, then the Northeast U.S., then an island off the coast of New York State. It plunges past the Empire State Building in the middle of Manhattan and comes to a stop at street level. It's a sunny summer day. People stream past, taxis honk, and we hear a faint rumble as a subway train passes beneath us. A beautiful woman in a red dress gives the camera a wink.
Man has long yearned to escape, to explore other worlds.
Suddenly, a shadow darkens the street.
But soon, we'll discover there's no place like home.
The camera pans up.
we see the underbelly of a giant winged creature that's sailing between skyscrapers.
Other Earth, says maybe Tom Cruise.
Your world, only better.
Someone hits mute, and we all sit in silence.
God, they looked awesome,
Elvis finally says. The dinner party. I have no idea where I am. My eyes are covered and my hands and legs are bound. I can't move an inch in any direction. Even my chest is wrapped so tightly that my avatar's lungs can barely expand enough to breathe. I feel the material against my fingertips. It's a silk as fine as my mother's scarves. I curse out loud when I realize what's happened. The last place I visited in Otherworld was the cave beneath the ice fields. When I was pulled out of the game unexpectedly, the spider child I met there must have wrapped up my avatar and hidden it along with Moloch's. Elvis is probably keeping us company. I guess that's the thanks we get for saving Spider Lady's butt. I get that she doesn't like guests, but what do you have to do these days to prove you're not a psychopath? There's a pain in the center of my chest where something hard is pressing into my flesh. The children let me keep the amulet, which seems like an improbable bit of good luck. A pale blue light filters through my silk blindfold. The stone knows I'm eager to go, and it's ready. I can't move my lips, but I don't need to. I think of the place I need to travel, and suddenly, I'm outside Imra. I'd rather be anywhere else, but there's one last trip Kat and I have to make before we say goodbye to this place forever. Kat's arranged a meeting with her stepfather. After we see Wayne, I don't intend to ever come back. Kat is waiting for me at the gates. She's wearing her camouflage bodysuit, which blends in so well that most of her appears to be a smudge on the graphics, but her head is uncovered, and her copper-colored curls flow freely. In Otherworld, the shaved strip on the back of her head is gone.
"What the heck happened here?" she asks.
I peer through the gates. The suburbs of Imra are deserted. Weeds have grown through cracks in the pavement. Red sand from the neighboring wastelands has blown in on the winds and formed small dunes against the sides of the buildings. I was here not that long ago, yet Otherworld's nature is already reclaiming realms. I'm starting to think time might be speeding up here. One of the guests killed all the NPCs, I say. Elvis and I watched him shoot one. Then he came after us.
The game didn't regenerate the NPCs after they died?
Kat asks skeptically.
I guess not, I realize. It is strange. When the children die, they're gone for good, but NPCs are just part of the game. They should have regenerated, but it looks as though they haven't.
I wonder what Imra's like now that its NPC workers are gone. And I wonder what the headset players will do when there's nothing in Otherworld left to shoot. I start walking before I even know where I'm going. Kat doesn't ask, she just stays beside me. Soon, we're standing in front of the green wall of ivy that once protected Gimmelwald. A wide hole has been burned through the center. Most of the vines surrounding the passage are dead. A few scorched tendrils are twitching. I can't imagine a torch like the one Elvis used ever causing this much damage. This required a much more powerful weapon. With Kat right behind me, I enter Vola's realm. There is nothing left of it. The land is black and empty. The fire spared nothing. The mutant vegetation is gone, and the structures that once resembled green monsters have all burned to the ground. Whatever fierce beasts lived here have been massacred. There's no sign of Gunther or the cottage that he lived in. I feel a sudden pain, as if someone has reached deep inside my chest and yanked out my heart. Elvis and I probably showed the murderer how to get inside.
Vola!
I shout, though I know I shouldn't. The guest responsible for all this destruction might not be far away.
Vola!
I shout again. There's no answer. Who is Vola? Kat asks. The elemental of Gimmelwald, I remind her. I can't bear to say more. I can't find the words to tell Kat about the little green baby or the promise I failed to keep.
I don't think guests can kill elementals, Kat tries to soothe me, though neither of us really knows the truth.
Maybe Vola fled with her child, but the chances are just as good that she's dead.
The rage takes me by surprise. It's more potent than anything I've felt since my trip to Nastrand. I manage to push it down deep in my belly, but as I stomp back through the hole in the vines, I can feel it burning and boiling like the molten rock inside Imra's volcano. It's only a matter of time before I explode. Imra and Nemi are separated by a swamp, one of the countless wastelands that separate the realms. It's unbearably hot and humid, but Kat and I are forced to keep our sleeves down and our hoods up. The insects here are large and hungry. I've seen mosquito-like creatures that could drain a man dry. We wade through rancid-smelling muck that reaches well past our knees. It's hard to believe that anyone would willingly spend time in this hellhole, but we're barely a mile in when we hear the first shot. It's followed by at least a dozen more. The spaces in between are filled with hooting and hollering. I glance over at Kat. She shakes her head and points in the opposite direction. We should do our best to avoid other guests, it's true. But there's a chance that one of these assholes may have destroyed Gimmelwald. There may be no judgments in Otherworld, but if I find the person responsible, he's going to pay for his sins.
Stay here, I whisper to Kat. I'll be right back.
Stop saying crap like that. She huffs in annoyance and readies her bow. If you're going somewhere, I'm going too. We stick together, no matter what. Moving slowly and silently, we make our way toward the gunshots. Soon, buildings appear in front of us. They're bayou-style wooden shacks that sit perched atop stilts that rise 4 feet out of the swamp. They look hand-built and weathered, not the sort of place that headset players would seek out. Yet there are 3 guests here. Their avatars are standing on a porch that surrounds one of the houses. 2 of the guests are burly, camo-wearing types. The 3rd is slender, with neatly combed dark hair. He's dressed in simple gray overalls, like a mechanic at a fancy car dealership. He watches passively, hands in his pockets, while the other 2 men shoot at something in the water. Whatever it is, they've hit it multiple times. The water is red and thick with blood, and there's a metallic stench in the air. Standing by the gray man's side is a child. I have no idea what 2 beings might have blended to produce the creature. It's human in appearance, though its waxy skin is as pale as a corpse, and its thick black hair has a bluish sheen. The creature's crisp navy outfit appears military in style, with a kilt that ends just above its knees. The legs sticking out of the skirt are rather ordinary, but the child's feet are bare, and it's rocking a massive tail.
"What are they shooting at?" Kat whispers.
She gets her answer almost immediately. A giant beast surfaces from the deep water around the building and lunges up at the avatars on the deck. It has the scales and snout of a crocodile, and it looks prehistoric. It snatches one of the camo-wearing avatars by the boot and drags him into the water. The 2nd man in camo lurches backward and falls on his ass. His gun lands a few feet away, discharging a bullet that splinters the bark of a nearby tree. There's silence for a moment as waves lap against the house's stilts. Then, the child begins to laugh. The deafening sound is more dolphin than human. Kat and I both shove our fingers in her ears. The humiliated avatar snarls and reaches for his weapon, but he's not quite fast enough. The man in gray already has a gun to his head.
"Go to hell, Alexei," the man on the ground sneers. "The next time I see your little pet, he's going to Karamojo with the rest of them."
He has an Eastern European bad guy accent, the origins of which I can't quite place. The gray man doesn't do so much as blink.
"Sit 1 foot in my swamp, Dimitri, and we will do this again."
He fires once, and the other avatar flashes.
"Over and over."
He fires again.
"Until you learn your lesson."
He pulls the trigger of his gun 3rd time. The fallen avatar flashes once more and disappears. The gray man then passes the gun to his companion.
"Go," I hear him tell the child. "Get the ones that were taken. Bring them back."
"Alexei," I mutter. That's what the other man called him, like the Russian oligarch Elvis mentioned back in New Mexico. I bet they're one and the same. Kat nudges me with her elbow.
"Did you see that?" she whispers. "The guest protected a child. Do you think we should speak to him? We could probably use some backup."
She sounds so hopeful that it almost breaks my heart. Cat probably thinks she's just witnessed proof that humanity isn't complete shit after all. I'm still not so sure. And one thing's for certain, we're not here to make friends.
We can't trust him, I tell her.
I don't know why the Gray Man is another world, but I do know that he's not like us. He's one of the 2,000. He's one of them. The hours we spent trudging through the swamp should have been some of the most miserable of my life, but I'd be lying if I didn't admit it was nice to spend some time alone with Cat. She was keen to avoid killing anything on our way to Nemi, but the beasts of Otherworld were determined to test her resolve. They came at us with teeth, claws, beaks, and stingers. Despite Cat's best intentions, we left a trail of carnage behind us. Now, we finally reached the edge of the morass, only to find ourselves standing on the shores of what appears to be an inland sea. Deadly beasts are one thing, but I wasn't prepared to face this kind of obstacle. How are we going to get across that? I ask Cat. We aren't, she says. This is Nemi. No sooner has the name left her lips than a massive pleasure barge appears on the horizon, moving swiftly our way. As it draws closer, I can see there's a garden planted on its deck, and two luxurious Roman-style structures positioned at either end. The boat crosses the water in mere seconds, without fluttering a frond on the palm trees in its gardens. It stops in front of us, and a gangway is lowered to the shore a few feet from where we're standing. You didn't mention we'd be heading out to sea. Are you sure this is safe? I ask Cat. Safe. This is Otherworld, remember? She replies. But I'm pretty sure we'll be the only guests. An NPC appears at the top of the gangway. He's wearing a navy blue uniform that's identical to the one worn by the child we saw in the swamp. He's holding an empty wooden box.
Your weapons, please,
he drones as Cat and I approach. Cat hands over her bow and arrows, but there's no way I'm giving the guy my dagger. Yeah, right. I try to slip around him, but I can't. Some invisible barrier keeps me from stepping onto the ship.
Your weapons, please,
the NPC repeats. What's going on? I ask Cat. Why do they want our weapons? That's the rule here, she responds. Nemi is the only realm I pass through where weapons aren't allowed. That's why I chose it for the meeting. Are you crazy? I demand under my breath. Have you forgotten the 2,000 psychopaths who've turned Otherworld into their personal slaughterhouse? Of course not, she replies. The weapons rule is one of the reasons Nemi stays empty. You're not supposed to kill anything here. I reluctantly toss my dagger into the box. I feel naked without it, but it turns out Cat's right. Though the boat is lousy with NPCs, all dressed in the same distinctive navy blue uniform, there don't seem to be any other guests. The weather couldn't be more perfect. The sky is cloudless and the sun golden. A gentle breeze washes over me, and I realize the boat has left the shore. I step over to the starboard railing and peer over the side. The water below is clear and blue, and there's a school of shimmering silver fish swimming past. I doubt they're the only creatures that live in this sea. It makes me nervous to realize that we'll soon be out in the middle of the water at the mercy of the barge's crew, with no way to get to shore on our own.
Welcome to Nemi.
Another uniformed NPC interrupts my worries. He's one of the blandest beings I've encountered in Otherworld, with a face I'll forget the second he's gone.
Would you care for a tour of the ship, or shall I guide you directly to your table?
Table? I'm confused again.
Nemi is known for its food, sir.
The NPC explains. There's the second reason no other guests come here, I guess. If you're wearing a disc, Otherworld food is irresistible, but headset players can't taste a thing. We're expecting a visitor, Cat notifies our host. The NPC nods.
Yes, madam. He's already on board. He's waiting for you both at the table.
A bolt of nervous energy shoots down my spine. Is he alone? I ask.
You three are our only guests at the moment,
the NPC confirms. Cat catches my eye. She looks like she'd rather trudge back through the swamp than sit down with our visitor. Let's get this over with, she says.
Very well. This way.
The NPC guides us towards the larger of the two buildings on board. Supporting the roof are 8 marble columns, and the walls are decorated with naughty murals of Roman-style gods at play. Sheltered from the sun is a square table surrounded on 3 sides by plush banquettes. Seated against the far wall is Wayne Gibson. He looks exactly as he does in the real world, right down to his chinos and button-up shirt.
Well, hello there.
Wayne glances down at his watch.
You two are late.
I was starting to think I might have misinterpreted your message.
We had to travel through a swamp to get here, I tell him. It took longer than we thought.
I sympathize,
he says, as though that were something he was capable of doing.
But you chose the time and place. I've never visited Otherworld, and it took me a while to get here myself, but I managed to be on time. Please.
Wayne gestures to the banquette to his right.
Have a seat. I see the food has arrived.
Before we can take our places, the NPC sets a platter down on the table in front of us. Piled on top are hundreds of small beasts that don't resemble anything I've ever seen. Their bodies have been roasted whole and stuffed, so full they're perfectly round. In the real world, the white stuffing that's escaping from their mouths would probably be cheese. In Otherworld, there's no telling what it might be. Yet, despite the revolting appearance, the smell wafting off the dish is intoxicating. Wayne reaches over and picks up one of the stuffed creatures and bites into it like an apple. I hear his teeth break through the skin and then the bones crunching between them.
Boy, I bet this tastes delicious, Wayne says. You two want to try one? I can't even imagine how amazing it must be with a disc.
The temptation is almost overpowering, but I know better than to fall for the trap. Once you start eating another world, it can be impossible to stop.
What's the problem?
Wayne asks with a grin.
You think I got here early just to have the food poisoned?
I wouldn't be surprised, Cat fakes a toothy smile. But I'd be a little more cautious if I were you. If anything happens to us, Milo Jokin's going to kick the bucket in a truly spectacular way. The company managed to pull its stock price out of the toilet with that Other Earth trailer, but if Milo commits suicide on camera, a new game is not going to save you.
So you'll have poor Milo jump off a roof, will you?
Wayne asks, popping the final bit of the beast into his mouth.
What will people say when they see there's no body splattered on the sidewalk below?
If Milo jumps off a bridge, there won't be a body to find, Cat informs him. Wayne chuckles warmly.
Clever, he admits. I always knew you were a smart girl. Maybe if you'd been a little less intelligent, you wouldn't be in all this trouble.
Cat smiles again and winks at me. I had no idea we were in such big trouble. Did you know, Simon? Nope, I play along. In fact, if anyone's in trouble, I'd say it's Wayne here. When the company goes belly up, he'll be out of a job. Nothing seems able to wipe the smile off this jerk's face.
So, what is it exactly you two want?
Wayne asks. We want you, the engineers, and the doctors who've worked on the disc project to turn yourselves into the authorities and confess to your crimes, I say. Wayne nearly busts a gut laughing.
Oh, nice try, kids.
I knew it wasn't going to happen, but I figured it was worth a shot. Fine, I say. But our next offer is our last offer. We want the company to destroy all Otherworld discs and kick all the headset players out of the game. And we want you to release Marlo Holm, James Agubu, and Declan Andrews, otherwise known as Gorog.
James Agubu?
Wayne looks genuinely surprised.
Now there's someone I haven't seen in ages.
I can't exactly hand a man over to you if I have no idea where he is. Last I heard, he walked off the job months ago. In fact, if you find him, tell James he's fired.
I'm not sure why, but for once, I think Wayne might be telling the truth. Though if no one at the company knows where James Ogbu is, what the hell did Milo do with him?
Forget Ogbu, then, Kat says. The rest is non-negotiable.
Wayne sits back with his arms crossed.
So, you really want us to destroy all the disks just when we're so close to completely debugging them? It could be a matter of days at this point. People died for that technology. One of them was a friend of Mr. Eden's, as I recall. Don't you want to respect Carol Elliott's sacrifice?
The name sends a jolt of rage through my system. Along with Gorog, Carol was one of my companions on my first trip to Otherworld. Without her, I wouldn't be alive. Carol was murdered. I have to shove my hands under my thighs to avoid strangling him.
All in the name of progress, Wayne says.
You must mean profits, I correct him.
More often than not, the two go hand in hand.
I stare at him across the table. The guy looks like a Boy Scout troop leader or a Little League coach. You'd never guess he was evil incarnate. You're a sick bastard, you know that? Wayne smirks and picks up another stuffed creature and pops it in his mouth.
You guys not gonna have any of this?
He asks, once he's finished chewing.
I'm sure you're really missing out on something special,
he says when neither of us responds. He lifts a finger and calls a waiter over. Three identical NPCs arrive at our table.
Are you finished with the dish, sir?
One of the NPCs asks.
I sure am, Wayne confirms. You can take it away. In fact, while you're at it, why don't you go ahead and take these two as well?
I'm still not certain I heard right when one of the NPCs grabs Kat by the shoulders and drags her out of her seat. Before I can do anything, the other two have my arms pinned behind me. I start to struggle. Then I see a dozen NPC reinforcements arrive.
What in the hell are you doing? Kat growls at Wayne. Didn't you hear? If anything happens to us, our friends will shove Milo Yolkin off a cliff. Your friends, Wayne repeats. You mean Busara Ogbu and Elvis Karaskovich?
He stops and smirks at what must be the look of pure horror on my face.
Oh, yes. We know who they are. It won't be long before we know where they are, too.
I'd ask how he got Elvis's name, but I'd rather not give him the satisfaction.
If you kill us, Elvis and Busara will make sure you're out of a job by the time you get back to the real world, I sneer. And in jail soon after that.
Catherine's life isn't in danger,
Wayne says, referring to Kat by the full name she's never used.
Her poor, crazy mother suffered enough already. I figure we'll find a way for the two of them to spend more time together. I'm on friendly terms with the man who runs the mental hospital where Linda's staying. He's already agreed to set aside a room for Catherine.
What about Simon? Kat asks.
Wayne shrugs.
Well, my dear, what happens to him will depend on you. First, we're going to give him a good ass-whooping to punish him for shooting me the night you two escaped from the facility. I figure that's only fair. As soon as his whole body feels as bad as my arm, I'm going to ask you to tell me where you and your friends are hiding out in New York. If you're forthcoming, I'll let Mr. Eaton live. If not, he'll die. And I'll find your friends anyway.
Wayne claps his hands, and two NPCs open up a trap door in the barge's deck. Then they disappear into the darkness below.
I bet you two aren't planning to stay in Otherworld forever. Someone back in New York's going to be taking your discs off soon. So, what do you say? Should we get this show on the road?
The NPCs reemerge with a creature in chains trailing behind them. There's no doubt it's a child. But I've never seen one this large before. He stands at least 7 feet tall, with broad shoulders and giant hands. His thick gray skin sags around his joints,
and two tusks lift his upper lip into a permanent snarl. He has elephant DNA, no doubt, but there's something else mixed in as well, something unusual.
"I know you depend on your dagger," Wayne tells me, "but as you've learned, weapons of all sorts are banned in Nemi, so I hope you won't mind a little hand-to-hand combat."
Now I know what this is all about. Wayne Gibson didn't come here to save the company. I made a mistake thinking he'd ever set aside his desire for revenge. His only goal right now is to make me suffer.
"You're saying you want me to fight this guy?" I ask.
"Forget it. I refuse."
"Fine by me," Wayne says. "It'll be less entertaining for the rest of us if you don't fight back, but I figure I'll be the winner either way."
As the child's chains are removed, the ship's NPCs form a circle around us. I could probably break through, but there's nowhere to go. I glance at the railing that rings the deck. I wonder if I could reach the shore if I managed to jump over the side.
"I wouldn't even consider that if I were you," Wayne warns me with a yawn. "There are some pretty big beasts down there in the water. All things considered, getting eaten by one seems like a pretty shitty way to go."
"You don't have to fight," Cat calls out to the child, who doesn't exactly look thrilled by the situation either.
"Kick his ass, and you'll earn your freedom," Wayne tells the child. "If you kill him, I'll set your friends free, too."
"He's lying," Cat cries as one of the creature's fists streaks through the air. Guess we just found out where his priorities lie. I barely have a chance to dodge the blow. I'm not quick enough to evade the next one. It hits me square in the stomach and sends me flying across the deck until my back hits the railing. While I do my best to suck air into my lungs, I see the child moving in my direction. He grabs the front of my cloak and lifts me up, only to slam me back down a split second later.
"Catherine, dear," I hear Wayne call out, "are you ready to tell us where you and your friends are hiding?"
"Don't," I manage to croak. I struggle to my feet and face the child. I can already taste blood in my mouth, and I don't think I'll be able to withstand another punch. When he comes at me, I make the only move I can. I step to the side. He's too big and moving too quickly to reverse course. As he charges past, I jump onto his back and climb toward his neck. Soon, I have the child in a chokehold. He's flailing about, but he can't reach me with his arms, and he can't shake me off. I squeeze until I lose all sensation in my right arm. Finally, he crashes to his knees and then hits the floor, unconscious. The deck is so silent I can hear the water lapping against the sides of the boat.
"Do it," Wayne orders me. "Finish the child off."
"Simon's hurt," Cat shouts. "You got your revenge. What else do you want?" But Wayne isn't swayed. In fact, he seems almost pleased by this turn of events. He sees the chance to do far more harm to me than a beating could ever deliver.
"Kill the child, Mr. Eaton, or I'll have the men here kill you."
"No." I let go of the child and rise to my feet. I walk toward Wayne and position myself with my back to the creature. He's awake now. I can hear him moving. He could easily attack, but he doesn't.
"Throw them both over the side," Wayne tells the NPCs.
The men take a step forward, and a gunshot rings out. Everyone on the boat looks startled by the sound. There shouldn't be any weapons in Nemi. Something hits the deck with a thud. I'm still breathing, so I assume the child must be dead. But then I see he's risen to his knees from the deck. One of the NPCs lies on the ground instead, blood spilling out of his body. The form vanishes, just as the child from the swamp appears on deck. His skin's still a bit chalky, and his wide-set eyes are pure black, but he has all the right features, and they're right where you'd expect them to be. I might even have mistaken him for a guest if the tail hadn't given his origins away. Avatars in Otherworld can be large or small, but they must assume a human form. He seems like he might be around my age, but I don't doubt for a moment that this creature's seen far more than I have. I expect the NPCs to attack the moment he appears, but instead, they line up as if awaiting new orders. The ones holding Cat have set her free, and she hurries over to join me. We stand shoulder to shoulder, waiting for the shit to hit the fan.
Go down to the hold,
the child orders the elephantine creature I was just fighting. His voice is calm and firm.
Release your companions and bring them up to the deck.
What the hell is going on? Why does this freak have a weapon?
I hear Wayne cry out in rage, but the NPCs don't answer. It seems they have a new master now.
All of you, swim to shore,
the child orders the NPCs. One by one, the men dive over the side and into the shimmering blue water. The loud splashing that follows tells me either the NPCs couldn't swim, or something was waiting down there to greet them.
Who are you?
Wayne demands.
My name is Fonz, and this boat is my home. My father is the elemental who rules this sea, which is why I'm allowed to carry weapons, if I please. My mother is the beast from below, says the child.
The second he says it, I realize that the appendage I'd assumed was a tail is actually a tentacle.
Now, if you don't mind my asking, who are you?
Someone you don't want to mess with.
Wayne bares his teeth like a rabid pit bull. For a second, I see the evil beneath his bland disguise.
Now give me the gun.
Fonz cocks his head and observes Wayne quizzically. He seems intrigued rather than intimidated.
You must be quite important if you feel you have the right to come to my realm and issue orders.
As far as you and your kind are concerned, I'm God.
This is Otherworld,
Fonz replies calmly.
We choose our own gods here.
Then he tilts his head back and calls out in a strange sing-song language. I have no idea what's happening until a shadow falls across the deck and I turn to see a giant tentacle rise up from the water. It towers over the ship before it swoops down to snatch Wayne. It squeezes his avatar until its face turns purple and its eyes bulge out like a cartoon character. When the body flashes and goes limp, the tentacle slams it back down on the deck. The avatar flashes once more when it hits, and the tentacle retreats, disappearing beneath the waves. Fonz aims his gun at Wayne's head and pulls the trigger. 3 kills in a row. Wayne's avatar is headed back to setup. As soon as the body disappears, the child turns his gun on me.
No! Kat shouts. Don't hurt him. We're not like the other guests. We don't murder your kind.
There's only one guest in Otherworld who neither murders nor lies, says Fonz. I've learned not to place my faith in the rest.
The female is telling the truth.
The giant elephant child steps between Fonz and me. He's reappeared topside with a group of other children who must have been imprisoned in the hold below.
The guest you shot forced the male to fight me. He had the chance to kill me, but he refused.
Fonz waves the elephant child to the side and steps up to where Kat and I stand. His nose twitches as if he's picking up a strange scent.
Why are you here in Otherworld if you don't want to kill?
He asks. Why is your friend in the gray coveralls here? I reply. He's a guest too, isn't he? The child smiles, and his mouth stretches all the way from one side of his face to the other. It's a rather disturbing sight.
You know Alexei?
We've never met him, Kat says, but we saw him kill the Avatar in the swamp to protect you. I don't think the child is happy to find out that someone was watching, but I'm almost relieved when his creepy smile disappears.
Why are you here?
He asks again, coldly. It's complicated, I tell him. I don't have time to recount the whole story.
You think I cannot understand? The child sneers at me. You imagine your kind is more intelligent than mine?
No, I assure him. We know the children are our equals. We're here to help them, not kill them. That's what the Creator would have wanted us to do. We knew Magna, Kat explains.
The man you just shot is the reason he's dead. His name is Wayne Gibson. He let Magna die so he could take over a company your creator founded. Now, he's responsible for the guests who are destroying your world. We thought we knew how to force him to get rid of them all, but our plan didn't work out the way we expected. That's putting it mildly. Everything's gone to hell. We might be able to